The Tel Aviv fears a renewed surge in anti-Israeli operations, especially after a rise in armed attacks against the Israeli regime. Mona Qandil, occupied Albira.
Britain has been thrown into another leadership crisis after outgoing Prime Minister Liz Truss announced her resignation after just 44 days in office. Her departure makes Truss the shortest-serving UK Prime Minister in British history and the fourth Tory to head the troubled nation in just 4 years.
I cannot deliver the mandate on which I was elected by the Conservative Party. I have therefore spoken to His Majesty the King to notify him that I am resigning as leader of the Conservative Party.
So now eyes turn towards who her successor will be. The ruling Conservative Party have chosen to ignore opposition calls for a general election.
This cannot continue. Britain deserves better. Britain cannot afford the chaos of the Conservatives anymore. We need a general election now.
The next Prime Minister is expected to be elected via another internal leadership race within the space of just 1 week. Speculation suggests that past leadership contenders Rishi Sunak and Penny Mordaunt both have their eye on the top job. Whilst current Chancellor Jeremy Hunt has ruled himself out of the race, former Prime Minister Boris Johnson has stunned many with rumours he may attempt a return. Truss's allies claim she stood aside graciously. However, critics believe she should be held accountable for her self-admitted mistakes.
Liz Truss leaving after just 44 days in power really epitomises the state of the current Conservative Party. Because think about it, if after 12 years of power, yet another Conservative Prime Minister is chased out after being unable to clean up the mess that their party created, well, what does it say about any other potential leadership candidate?
Going forward, it's expected things are going to move very rapidly, with Tory MPs expected to put forward their nominations on Monday, with an election process concluded by Friday the 28th, and with a new Prime Minister in place in time for October the 31st's fiscal statement. However, it's surely going to take much more than a speedy election process to restore the nation's lost confidence in the ruling Conservative Party. Robert Carter, London.
A once foreign minister, Amir Abdullahian, has paid a visit to EB House, an NGO supporting patients suffering from a rare skin disorder that causes the skin to become fragile, known as epidermolysis bullosa. During the visit, which came on the occasion of the EB Awareness Week, Iran's top diplomats said imposing unilateral sanctions have become a modern tool for the U.S. to violate human rights.
Imposing unilateral sanctions have become a modern tool for the U.S. to violate human rights. There are 1,300 EB patients in Iran, but Sweden refuses to give special bandages to these patients. This comes as Westerners have repeatedly declared that sanctions do not include patients and medicine, but in practice, they act the opposite.
The Swedish company Mölnlycke Healthcare has refused to sell Iranian EB patients medical care items they needed, including Mepilex dressings. Several children in Iran who suffered from epidermolysis bullosa lost their lives due to the lack of urgently needed medical equipment, and some others were hurt by severe physical injuries, including amputation.
Iran has serious problems in procuring wound dressings for EB patients. These dressings are produced in Sweden, but the country refrains from providing us with the bandages because of the U.S. sanctions. Our center has filed a lawsuit in the judiciary of the Islamic Republic to pursue the problem, and we expect the Foreign Ministry and the administration of President Raisi to follow up the case because the lives of my daughter and other patients are in danger.
Many human rights groups have criticized the U.S. for cutting off banking ties with Iran through threatening international banks with punitive fines by the U.S. Department of Treasury, which has resulted in cutting Iranian patients' access to necessary medical items. Tens of Iranian EB patients, mostly children, have died since Swedish company Mölnlycke stopped selling its dressings to Iran. Since then, for EB survivors, the pain has increased by 70%.
Iran says the West is taking revenge on Iranians by waging a campaign of genocide against patients, believing that the sanctions have become the backbone of the so-called American human rights regulations. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
A high-ranking Palestinian delegation has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. Arriving from Algeria, officials discussed the result of their meetings there for reconciliation among Palestinians. Assad underlined the importance of unity among Palestinians as a source of strength in the face of the Israeli aggression and for regaining their rights. He asserted that Syria will always remain in support of resistance against Israel. Members of the delegation expressed appreciation for Syria's historic support to Palestinians, describing it as their safe haven during hardships. They said they stand beside Syria in this years-long war waged by the U.S. and its allies. Following the meeting, representatives of Palestinian factions held a press conference.
The president welcomed us in an open heart and expressed Syria's love to Palestine, Palestinians, Palestinian cause and resistance, as well as determination for this meeting to pave the way for a new phase of relations between Syria and Palestinian factions.
The most significant aspect of the visit was that Hamas officials were present. This is their first visit to Syria in a decade after they left, cutting ties with the Syrian government at the start of Syria's crisis. During the press conference, Hamas officially announced the restoration of relations with Syria.
This is a glorious and important day. We restore our presence in Syria and joint action with Syrian-based Palestinian factions and the Syrian government in support of our cause. We told Assad that we support a unified Syria and we are against any aggression on Syria.
The visit comes shortly after Palestinian factions came together under Algerian Reconciliation Initiative, in which they met and agreed to end disputes and division for the sake of unifying ranks in the face of Israel. Palestinian factions' visit to Syria reiterates the Arab country's pivotal role in supporting Palestinian resistance against Israel, even during the war it is facing. And receiving Hamas officials in Damascus is yet another proof of Syria's commitment to the Palestinian cause, despite Hamas's stance over the Syrian crisis and disagreements in 2012. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Since the beginning of the Saudi-led coalition war on Yemen on March 2015, attacks on education centers have severely disrupted access to education. A recent UN report says over 2,900 schools have been destroyed, partially damaged, or used for non-educational purposes. Even though the world body did not mention the cause of the destructions in its report, most of the schools were hit by the Saudi aerial attacks.
Since the beginning of the war against our country, the Saudi-led coalition has been seeking to target the educational system because the enemy realizes the importance of education and its role in the society. So the coalition cut the salaries of employees, including teachers, which negatively affected the country's education. Due to the war, we were only able to print a very small percentage of the textbooks, and the poor living conditions forced many children to leave education and enter the labor market to support their families.
For its part, the International Committee of the Red Cross has urged the international community to save the education system in the country. It says there are over 2 million children out of school and over 8 million students need support to access education.
Over 2 million children don't have access to proper education in Yemen, and one out of four of all primary and secondary schools have been damaged or have been used for purposes other than what they're intended for. This is exacerbated by internally displaced people using some schools as shelters as they are forced to flee from their homes to escape the ongoing conflict. Of course, education will have long-lasting effects and ramifications that will indeed impact the Yemeni people for generations to come.
Structured learning has been further hindered as 172,000 teachers have been irregularly paid since 2016, while some have not been paid at all. Sadly, some teachers could not even cover the transportation costs as they are working voluntarily.
Despite all the challenges, education remains the safety net for future generations. Therefore, Yemenis say they will keep pushing their children to schools, hoping to build a generation that will reconstruct the country after the Saudi-led war. Abdulatif Loshali, Sana'a.
Following weeks of unrest between Muslims and Hindus in the English Midlands city of Leicester, the local mayor has ordered an inquiry to get to the bottom of what's behind the rise in local tensions. Following the inquiry's launch, Leicester City Mayor Peter Salisbury met with local Muslim community activists on October the 11th, who expressed fears that the violence was largely the result of the arrival of an Indian Hindu supremacist political ideology known as Hindutva on British shores.
Lots of tough questions. You'd expect that. I mean, it's quite right. People, you know, are concerned about what happened, concerned about what it means, concerned about the ideology that lies behind it.
A Press TV investigation into the unrest found that a number of local Muslim residents had been hospitalised this year following attacks allegedly carried out by Islamophobic Hindu gangs, likely inspired by India's Hindutva ideology. Muslim activists informed Press TV that locals felt the police had failed to protect their community, leading to a fight back.
However, it isn't just Muslims who fear the arrival of Hindutva. British Sikhs are also well acquainted with the supremacist ideology, which preaches total intolerance of all of India's religious minorities.
The Hindutva is a fascist ideology that seeks the racial, social, religious purity of India and unification of India as an embodiment of Hinduism. So one nation, one language, and now with Modi, one market, where the Hindu is the human, the Hindu is the subject that is protected, and every other minoritized community is a threat, a potential threat to the integrity of India. It's a mythical project.
Hindu organisations in Britain have condemned the violence, but none seem to have acknowledged the accusations of Hindutva-inspired hate as a cause to the troubles. Muslim and Sikh onlookers hope that the inquiry will put the Hindutva ideology firmly under the spotlight. Robert Carter, London.
Washington is poised to spearhead yet another military intervention in protest-racked Haiti and will even propose a non-United Nations mission to do so. Anti-government protesters have become routinely labeled gang members in the Western mainstream media. However, many say that such a negative characterization aims to smooth Western public opinion for the use of force in Haiti yet again.
Even calling them gangs in some ways might be misleading. Some of these groups are political organizations, and the state is so weak because state institutions have been eroded by neoliberal policies, by corruption, by neocolonial policies, that these forces that are leading these protests could potentially have the power to overthrow this U.S. puppet government.
Haitian instability escalated following the 2021 assassination of President Jovenel Moïse by Colombian mercenaries. Western mainstream media have reported that several of the assassins worked alongside U.S. intelligence groups. Haitian media accuses Washington of hiding evidence to keep its role in the murder a mystery.
Who replaced him? A U.S. puppet named Ariel Henry, who's the current president. Ariel Henry has no democratic mandate, and he has a long history of serving U.S. imperial interests in Haiti. In fact, he got his political start in being involved in the coup backed by the U.S. that ousted the progressive, popular president, Aristide, who was the first ever democratically elected president of Haiti.
Haitian civil society groups have emphatically rejected the prime minister's call for foreign intervention. There is also widespread denunciation for the West, which continues to back the government despite its decision to indefinitely postpone elections and a constitutional referendum. Many protesters have called upon Beijing and Moscow to use their UN Security Council veto to reject an official United Nations mission. In 2010, UN peacekeepers caused an outbreak of cholera which killed 10,000 Haitians and infected nearly 1 million, with sexual assault scandals commonplace. For over two centuries, Haitian sovereignty has been regularly subjugated, first by France and then by the United States. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
After weeks of economic and political turmoil, an early announcement by the UK's new finance minister aimed at calming the nerves at home and abroad.
Although the Prime Minister and I are both committed to cutting corporation tax, on Friday she listened to concerns about the mini-budget and confirmed we will not proceed with the cut to corporation tax announced.
And with that, Jeremy Hunt reversed most of an economic package announced by his predecessor, Kwasi Kwarteng, just weeks ago, including a planned cut to income tax.
It made no sense economically. It made no sense politically. And basically, the markets couldn't make any sense of it either. So basically, you've ended up wasting a lot of time and energy reversing a stupid policy that was put in the first place. Simple as that.
But not everything is being reversed. The government is still going to end the cap on bankers' bonuses, meaning bankers will be able to take home more than double their fixed salary when the change is made. And then there is the cap on household energy bills, Liz Truss's most popular policy, that was supposed to be in place for 2 years. It'll now be reviewed in April next year. Much of the economic and political turbulence in the UK is blamed on the war in Ukraine and unpredictable global market forces. Many experts say there is another important culprit.
Ultimately, a lot of this nonsense and the idiocy of Boris Johnson, the idiocy of Liz Truss, actually, its roots are in Brexit. Because what has Brexit done to the British economy? It's basically knocked 4 to 5% off the GDP. That's led to a loss of tax revenues for the government. It's led to problems for business because they haven't got the supply of labour that they need. All right? And it's basically acted and a huge waste of money, of course, on customs officials and this and that, and the bureaucracy for business.
Liz Truss's premiership has been nothing less than a roller coaster. Her decisions have given the opposition Labour Party a comfortable lead in opinion polls and badly damaged her credibility with her own party.
With the new Chancellor ripping up her economic plan, the Prime Minister now has to regain support of the MPs. But with the amount of plotting that's going on against her, whether or not she can do that is anyone's guess. Syed Bourza, London.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Analysis of recent events in Iran. In this program, we examine Western efforts to create turmoil, instability, and civil war in Iran, as well as Western efforts to disintegrate and break up the Islamic Republic. Please stay with us. One of the principal objectives of the enemies of the Islamic Revolution has been to bring about the collapse of the Islamic Republic and the disintegration of Islamic Iran. This has been their main objective since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in February of 1979. They have used every opportunity to strike a blow at Iran. Their hostility knows no bounds. This amount of hostility, plots and schemes directed at a popular democratic nation is certainly rare, if not unprecedented. The soft war being waged against Iran by mainstream Western media, the media campaign against Iran by American and British media, are all part of Western efforts during the past 43 years to stifle the Islamic Republic. The current unrest and rioting in Iran can also be seen through this perspective. The Zionist regime of Israel and some backward reactionary Arab regimes of the region have also tried to fuel the unrest in Iran. When Islamic Iran was just a fledgling state back in 1979, separatist and secessionist groups became active, particularly in the border regions of the country, in provinces such as Kurdistan, Khuzestan, and Azerbaijan. The terror groups used guns against the people, ironically, in the name of the people. This separatist sedition was still playing out when the not-so-clever former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, egged on by both the West and the East, decided to invade Iran militarily. The Ba'athist army crossed Iran's southern and western borders, initiating a full military invasion, and somewhat naively, they expected to push all the way to the capital, Tehran, in a matter of days. But unexpectedly for the Ba'athists, they encountered a massive and determined Iranian resistance, resistance by the Iranian people. 8 years of war followed, and a much more powerful and modern Iran emerged after the fighting. In the years following the war, Iran made enormous progress in many areas of science and technology, including aerospace technology, peaceful civilian nuclear technology, biotechnology and stem cell research, microelectronics and nanotechnology. Iran also made huge strides in development of military hardware and weapon systems, so much so that we became a regional power in West Asia, and no one even dared to think about attacking us. Surprisingly, all this progress was made in the years following the 8-year imposed war, when Western countries, led by the United States of America, slapped the most stringent of sanctions and boycotts against Islamic Iran. Former US President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew the United States from the landmark nuclear accord with Iran in May of 2018, to the surprise of everyone. Donald Trump didn't like the agreement because it was reached by his predecessor, Barack Obama, and he decided to follow a policy of maximum sanctions and maximum pressure against Tehran. This was tantamount to economic terrorism against the Islamic Republic. Just 3 years later, at the end of his presidency, Donald Trump was forced to acknowledge that his policy of maximum sanctions had been a failure and had not achieved any of its objectives. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, commented on this policy of maximum sanctions by saying, "They pulled out all the stops. They did everything they could to break the resistance and the will of the Iranian people. They used economic pressure and cultural assault. Whenever a country resists the hegemonic powers, they try to make it passive and inactive. The biggest mistake one can make against the enemy is to be passive and inactive. This is a huge mistake. We must never regard the enemy as weak or unworthy. We must always regard the enemy as dangerous. We must always be prepared to confront the enemy, be vigilant and alert, and we must never be afraid of the enemy. We must not be intimidated by it. Remember, the biggest mistake is to be inactive and passive vis-a-vis the enemy." Despite the huge economic pressure, The Iranian nation has succeeded in neutralizing and bypassing many of the unjust sanctions imposed against us. But this did not signify an end to the hostilities against Islamic Iran by United States and its European allies. Their aim is to split Iranian society, open up a chasm between young Iranians and the government, pit Iranians against one another. They don't want just regime change in Tehran, they want to create a civil war inside Iran and disintegrate the country, splitting it into several regions. In the words of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, "The US is not just against the Islamic Republic, it is also against a strong, independent Iran. They are after the Iran of the Pahlavi era. Iran was to them a milking cow. The Shah submitted to their orders, and when in quandary, he often asked to see the US ambassador or the British ambassador to ascertain what course of action he should take. How can the Iranian nation tolerate this shame? This is what the enemies want. They are opposed to an independent and a powerful Iran." The leader has also commented on the double standards of the United States and the West with regards to the recent riots in Iran. He said, "Many riots take place in the world. Every now and then, there are large riots in Europe, especially in France and in Paris. But has the US President or the US House of Representatives ever supported the rioters and issued a statement? Is there any record of them sending a message saying that we stand with the demonstrators in France? Is there any record of the mass media, which is affiliated with American capitalism and the US client regimes, such as some regional governments like Saudi Arabia, supporting rioters in those countries? But such support against the Islamic Republic of Iran has happened repeatedly. There is no doubt that the enemies of the Islamic Republic use every opportunity and every means at their disposal to strike a blow against Iran. They are currently using social media networks to wage an extensive media campaign, a fully-fledged media war against Iran. They can use a variety of issues, such as the sad death of a young girl, to initiate turmoil and rioting within the country." There is dissatisfaction within Iran with regards to the government's performance and the current economic situation of the country. What is certain is that peoples of many other countries are also dissatisfied with the performance of their governments. For example, in many European countries we see industrial action, we see demonstrations and protests in response to rising food and fuel prices, rising inflation and the cost of living crisis. But in none of those European countries do we see active support from outside of the country for the demonstrators, for those who engage in rioting, and we don't see interference in the internal affairs of those countries by the United States and Canada. The United States, Canada, and some European countries are more Catholic than the Pope. They pretend to care about the Iranian people, even more so than the Iranian government. And they criticize the Iranian security forces for attempting to establish order and peace in the country. They openly interfere in the internal affairs of the Islamic Republic and stoke tensions within the country. But their own dreadful human rights record and long-running persecution and genocide of indigenous peoples makes them particularly unsuitable for lecturing on this issue. For example, the recent grim discovery of a mass grave containing the remains of hundreds of Indigenous Canadian children, Canada's First Nation, who were forcibly taken away from their families and taken to special schools where they were mistreated and persecuted. Or the centuries-long persecution and killing of Native Americans in the United States. Given this background, how on earth can they claim the moral high ground? Under these circumstances, the Canadian Prime Minister threatens Iran with sanctions, using the unfortunate death of a young Iranian woman as a pretext. social media sites are currently doing all they can to create turmoil and crisis in Iran. Western governments are making instrumental use of these social media sites to spread disinformation, prevarication, and lies in Iran. These particularly target young Iranians. No doubt, the Iranian nation, particularly the younger generation, will overcome the current difficulties and will navigate their way through the crisis which has been created by the West. No doubt, the Islamic Republic of Iran will maintain its independence, will maintain its strength and authority, and will emerge with flying colours from this difficult period.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Israel's occupation of Palestinian territory is unlawful under international law. That's what a UN-appointed commission of inquiry has said. The Rights Commission has called on the UN to end Israel's permanent occupation and urges prosecution of Israeli officials. As expected, Tel Aviv rejected the report as being anti-Semitic. In this edition of Spotlight, we'll discuss the different aspects of the report and examine the role of the International Court of Justice and other international bodies in holding Israel accountable for its crimes against Palestinians. Joining us for tonight's discussion, we have manager at Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas Al-Najm, joining us from Toronto. And also from Vancouver, international coordinator at Samarun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, Ms. Charlotte Cates.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Ms. Cates in Vancouver. The report by the UN's Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the occupied Palestinian territory, which in fact will be presented to the General Assembly later in October, accuses Israel of violating international law by making its control over the West Bank permanent and by annexing land claimed by the Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds and the West Bank and Syrian land in the Golan Heights. Well, there have been many reports in this regard. In your opinion, what makes this report different?
In a lot of ways, this report isn't necessarily different, because we have seen, many, many very good reports published by many good UN commissions and agencies over the years that establish the incontrovertible facts that the Israeli occupation routinely violates international law. And in fact, I mean, when we look at the entire creation of the Zionist project on the land of Palestine, this is an exercise of colonialism. Colonialism itself is illegal under international law. So it really even goes beyond the 1967 military occupation to the nature of the Zionist settler project itself. What it does show, however, is that despite the influence of imperialist states like the United States, Canada, European Union countries, the UK, that there still is a measure of independence, and that the fact is that all of the military, political, and diplomatic support provided for the Zionist project by these states is not able to cover up, obscure, or hide the truth of the matter, which is that the Palestinian cause is a just struggle for justice, liberation, and return, and that on a daily basis, it is Palestinian rights that are being violated by an ongoing, you know, Zionist onslaught of mass imprisonment, extrajudicial killings, occupation, colonization, siege, denial of the right of return, and crimes that go on and on for 74 years.
Feras Al-Najm, the report says there are reasonable grounds to conclude that the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory is unlawful under international law due to its permanence and the Israelis' de facto annexation policies. Of course, it says that this should not deprive the occupied power of its statehood nor its sovereignty. When will these condemnations go past just being mere platitudes? When will there be action?
Unfortunately, the United Nations is a biased body, and they have not really done anything for the Palestinian cause. They have never imposed sanctions or passed real resolutions that make real changes and punish and penalize the Zionist war criminal regime and the occupiers of the Holy Land of Palestine. And it's a continuous thing. We've been seeing this for 74 years, and it does not stop. I mean, every month there's some type of aggression. Every few days now it's more constant now because they feel, there's nobody's going to punish them. The United Nations is quiet. Most of the international key players are quiet as well. And, the ones with the veto power and so on. I mean, few countries are speaking out and putting pressure and supporting the Palestinians. And one of them, obviously, is the Islamic Republic of Iran. That's why there's a huge campaign to defame them right now and to paint this wrong picture, the human rights abusers, where they forget about the real human rights abusers. It's the Zionist regime. How much annexation? How many houses have they stole from Palestinians? And it's been recorded because of this modern technology that we have. How many phones were used to really, highlight these issues of human rights violations? International law is being breached day and night by the Zionist regime. And the thing is, the Zionist regime really just disregards all these bodies because they've never held them really accountable. It's unfortunate, like even when the International Criminal Court, the ICC, was looking to investigate the Zionist regime for war crimes, the former prime minister of the Zionist regime comes out and says this is a kangaroo court. He says we don't even recognize it. So this is the type of rhetoric, this is the type of language these people have. They think they're above the law, they have the state of arrogance. And unfortunately, the only way it seems like it works with the Zionist regime is by military ways and military means. And we've seen that things change once the strength of the Palestinian resistance, hits the Zionist regime. We see that now with Gaza, they negotiate differently and they pull back and they retract and they become submissive, even though they have all the type of advanced weapons. But this strong, united resistance against the Zionist regime, I think, is the only solution. Because if we want to rely on the United Nations, we've seen they haven't done nothing. How come they have always spoke about these issues, have had condemnations and statements, but we haven't seen any real action? But we see now real action on the issue of Russia and Ukraine. How much sanctions have been imposed against Russia? How many meetings, important and emergency meetings have happened in the United Nations to condemn Russia, to impose all types of restrictions and sanctions against Russia and all its officials and so on? And it's only a conflict less than 1 year. We're talking 74 years of occupation. For us as a human rights organization, we don't want to see violence. We don't want to see people dying. We don't want to see destabilization. But at the end of the day, we have to be logic, and we have to look at things, you know, in a realistic way. And the realistic way is that the Zionist regime is only dealt with and things change when resistance is strong.
Charlotte Cates, that's an issue I wanted to bring up later on in the show, but now that Mr. Najem alluded to it, can we try and draw some comparison between the international response to the Ukraine conflict and the seven-decade-old occupation of Palestine? Why hasn't Israel been sanctioned and pressured and shunned by the international community to end its occupation of Palestinians?
Well, I think here it's always really important to talk about who we mean when we say the international community, because by and large, that term is used to mean the imperialist powers that are responsible for creating war, occupation, colonialism, extraction of resources from people around the world. And so the term international community, as if the responsible international community are those who are responsible for the ongoing war crimes and crimes against humanity. And so the reason why we see a difference in these responses and such a clear and striking difference isn't even that these states are hypocritical or that they have double standards. It's that they have interests, and that their interests are in seeing Zionist colonial power extended in occupied Palestine and dividing the Arab people and dividing the people of the region from one another through the presence of this essentially military colonial project of the Zionist state in occupied Palestine. And so in much the same way, we see that that the United States is very much pursuing a war by multiple means against Russia and against any other power that it views as a potential challenger to its domination of the extraction of the resources of colonized and formerly colonized people around the world. And so it's no surprise that these imperialist powers are acting in their interests. But that's not the only international community, and that's not the only international community that matters. Obviously, there are a number of states, I mean, including Iran, and including Arab states that have not yet conceded to the role of normalization, including resistance forces like we see in Lebanon, and including popular movements and people's movements around the world, both in the global south and the countries that have risen up against colonialism and continue to defend themselves, and in the capitals, the cities, the streets, and the towns of the imperialist powers themselves, that recognize that what is happening in Palestine is, in fact, a grand crime against humanity, and one that is being supported by U.S. imperialism, and one that needs to be brought to an end and to be stopped. And so that's why we are seeing a growth in campaigns to boycott and sanction Israel. And that's why instead what we're seeing are these imperialist powers instead trying to criminalize those boycott movements while saying that it is necessary to use sanctions as kind of a weapon of domination and control against countries from Iran to Russia to, you know, really one third of the world are subjected to U.S. sanctions of some form or another. And so it's really necessary to do everything that we can to build up that real international community, that real international community of all of those forces that are involved in resistance to fight back and to stand with the Palestinian people and to stand with the Palestinian resistance for the liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea, because we can't rely on the United Nations. Instead, we have to act and organize.
Faraz Al-Najem, the Israelis have rejected this report, obviously, calling its commissioners as being anti-Semitic and questioning their legitimacy. They say the report damages the UN's credibility and its human rights mechanisms. Also, U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price said that Israel is consistently unfairly targeted in the UN system, including in the course of this commission of inquiry. How hypocritical are these responses?
I mean, you know, this is the hypocrisy of the Zionist regime, because it was established on hypocrisy and contradiction. And, you know, this is what they always try to accuse people of, this victim card. And either they play the Holocaust card and try to, you know, play the victim card all the time, so, you know, people can have empathy for them, and you know, they want to justify crimes by looking at crimes that have happened to, let's just say, the Jewish people before, or they play the anti-Semitic card, and play the victim card again, you know, because they run out of cards now. They're in a very weak state right now, the Zionist regime. So they'll just keep throwing these type of cards around, and they don't get nowhere with them, you know what I mean? At the end of the day, they think they're above the law. Like, when we argue with these people all the time and have different discussions and arguments and protests, we see that their mentality truly is that they believe that they are the chosen people, this is their chosen land, and this is their chosen battle. And they're brainwashed in this kind of manner, you know what I mean? And they don't care about international organizations, and they think that, you know, God is assisting them in this all these criminal activities. But at the end of the day, we know that the resistance will enter Palestine. The resistance is strong, and the axis of resistance is more unified and more experienced now than ever in its history. And like Sayyid Khamenei said, the supreme leader of the Iranian government, he said that the solution is for the West Bank to be armed as Gaza, just something similar to Gaza, like the same model. Hopefully that will transfer to West Bank. And we see that right now. There is an ignition, and there is this reviving revolutionary lifestyle happening now, where a lot of youth are rising up and fighting back the Zionist regime, while they think they can just, you know, breach the international laws, go into Palestinian territories as they please, break all these, you know, people's houses and things like that. And, you know, we're hopeful. I mean, like us, freedom people are defending the people that are oppressed. We are really honestly hopeful that we're going to see a free Palestine in the near future. And it's unfortunate, this hypocrisy, where they're crying about one controversial case such as Mahsa Amini, and then they leave all the dead people that get killed in Palestine, such as Shirin Abu Akla, and all these people that we see clearly how the Israelis don't even care about any humanity at all. They kill women, they kill kids, they kill mothers, grandmothers, you know, and nobody speaks about them. There's no outrage. There's no huge, Twitter hashtags being trended by all these government officials and all these organizations and all these activists, you know. But they focus on that one case because they want to hurt Iran, because Iran is the main supporter of Palestine, and that's what hurts them. They hate a sovereign Iran and a strong Iran supporting the oppressed resistance of Palestine.
Charlotte Cates, the commission demanded the international system and individual states must act and uphold their obligations under international law. That must begin at this session of the General Assembly with the referral to the International Court of Justice on the legal consequences of Israel's continued occupation. This is, of course, an excerpt of the report from the commission. How can the ICJ have the leeway to intervene when Israel is not a member of the court and rejects its jurisdiction?
Yes, I mean, the ICJ has, of course, ruled before on Israeli crimes in 2004, on the building of the apartheid wall. And of course, at the ICC, in addition to what's happening at the ICJ, at the ICC, what we've seen is that, like, for example, legal organizations that are working to bring Palestinians' complaints to the ICC are being branded by the Zionist regime as terrorist organizations, essentially in retaliation for what they're doing to expose the Israeli occupation. We know that these kinds of agencies and even these courts aren't going to act on their own, because they're also not apolitical institutions. So, for example, at the ICC, we've seen an announcement that Ukraine, once again, is being prioritized, whereas Palestine has been waiting for justice at the ICC for a very long time. And in fact, the entire decision to handle their case was viewed as controversial and almost at risk at any time, despite the fact that there is an international recognition of a Palestinian state, however limited and insufficient that is. But that, once again, speaks to the fact that we see justice in the courts and in international arenas when we demand and seek justice in the streets, and when the Palestinian resistance is organizing, leading, and fighting back. And that's why it is so important that we participate in actions. On October 29th, there's going to be a march in Brussels to the European Parliament to demand an end to the European Union's complicity in ongoing Zionist war crimes and crimes against humanity through, for example, we see the EU Israel Association Agreement, meeting with Israeli occupation leaders, and even when issuing weak criticisms, providing nothing more than strong, fundamentally diplomatic, military, financial, and political support to the Zionist regime. And so we want to encourage people everywhere that you can to support the Palestinian people in their resistance by taking to the streets, by coming out and marching, and by joining us in Brussels on October 29th to march to the European Parliament at 2 p.m.
For us, Najim, the report focused on a very important issue, and that's the issue of settlements, on how Israel has sustained and advanced its quote-unquote settlement enterprise, including statements made by Israeli officials indicating the intent to maintain permanent control over the land in violation of international law. The report also found that land is often confiscated for military purposes, but then used for settlement construction. What are the Israelis achieving with this land grab policy? Apart from Judaization of Palestinian land, are the Israelis also deliberately sabotaging any prospects of future Palestinian statehood?
Yes, I mean, this is part of their, plan is to weaken the Palestinians and always show them military pieces everywhere, in every corner, so, you know, they can never think that they would ever have their own army and their own state and their own strength and sovereignty. This is one of the main focuses of the Zionist regime, because they know that after they get that strength, then they will start to talk about all the human rights abuses for over these years, all the war crimes, then they will be talking about compensation, bringing back all the refugees from Palestine. So that means their plan would have to fail, and they won't be able to fully control the land the way that they want to. So this is one of their plans, and it will fail. I think the only type of resolutions we can have to put some pressure, obviously, if the United Nations wakes up, actually, and really wants to implement the laws truly, and put some severe sanctions against Israel, maybe they'll retract a little bit and start to pull away from these settlements. Or the other way is obviously the Palestinian resistance and the rockets, because then, you know, at that point, the settlers and occupiers will feel discouraged and feel, you know, fearful that they have to leave that area because the Palestinians want their land back and they're going to fight for it. And, you know, well, like we said, we don't want to see no bloodshed. But if that's the only way it is to acquire your land and to liberate your land, then that's the only way. And it's also, it's sanctioned in the Charter of Rights under the United Nations. And any occupied nation has the right to resist, right? And as we see right now, the Ukrainians are getting all types of weapons from Canada, from all types of countries. And it's totally legal and it's totally honorable. But then when somebody wants to help the Palestinians, he's a sponsor of terrorism. It's like Iran supports the Palestinian resistance, inside Gaza, and they call them sponsors of terror. You see the hypocrisy and the biased type of actions is unbelievable, you know. But it's all turning on them anyways because we're exposing them. We're going out to these politicians and we're asking them, like, if you're supporting Ukraine and you're so proud of that, why don't you support the Palestinians that have been occupied for 74 years? And if you don't believe that they've been occupied, the United Nations says they're occupied. And now we have, you know, these